This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 17th of February 2012 on Monocle 24. Welcome to Midori House. We're live from Studio One at Monocle 24. I'm Christian Yeo. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be joined in the studio by journalist Ben Anderson to discuss his new book, a gripping account of the Afghanistan war in Helmand Province. We'll explore the press freedoms of Latin America, in particular Ecuador, where the president has sued a newspaper for $40 million. And we'll be casting our gaze to Oslo when we check in with our culture editor, Robert Bound. And we'll be meeting another Midori House neighbour, the Ginger Pig, Marylebone's finest butcher.
We know where our animals came from. We can tell for customers that information, which is very good, and they love that.
All that, plus some great music as well, right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But before all that, let's get the latest news from around the world with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. Rupert Murdoch has vowed to launch a Sunday edition of his scandal-hit Sunday Sun tabloid today in a bid to win over angry staff, mounting one of the biggest challenges to his more than 40 years as a proprietor here in Britain. The 80-year-old has said that News Corp would soon launch the paper to replace the News of the World, which was abruptly shut last year after an inquiry into telephone hacking to generate stories. Well, a small group of protesters are currently outside News International's offices here in London, saying that Rupert and James Murdoch are not fit and proper to own global media firms. Michael Calderbank is the spokesman for the Avaz Murdoch campaign.
It's ridiculous that these people are considered fit and proper persons to own a stake in the British media. And, you know, our business is not to put Sun journalists out of business, but it is to limit the unaccountable power of the media barons. And I think that Murdoch typifies that kind of power and its corrupting influence on public life.
Meanwhile, the National Union of Journalists say staff on the tabloid Sun feel betrayed by News Corporation. The Israeli diplomat's wife, who was injured in a New Delhi bomb attack on Monday, has been released from hospital and may soon be on her way home, according to her doctor. Talia Corrin was on her way to pick up her children from school when the bomb attached to her embassy car exploded. She suffered shrapnel wounds in the blast, which also injured her driver and two people in another car. Ashok Banot, a New Delhi hospital doctor, says she was making good but gradual progress.
She has improved from her surgery. She is recovering from the surgical site and as well as the wounds which she had sustained by the explosion. And she is showing good signs of recovery gradually.
Scores of Jordanian and Syrian activists rallied near the Russian and Syrian embassies in Amman today to protest against Russia's support of the Syrian government and show solidarity with protesters in Syria. Protesters from the Strong Islamist Movement joined the angry crowd as they chanted anti-Russian slogans and called on Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to step down. Russia and China have blocked UN Security Council resolutions condemning the violent crackdown on protesters in Syria, drawing international condemnation for allowing the killings to continue. The world's first pop-up mall, Box Park, has opened up in London's fashionable East End, where retail meets shipping container, literally. The shopping complex consists of 60 retail units and sits on a 4.7 hectares of a former railway and goods yard. It's now home to more than 60 carefully chosen fashion brands and restaurants. Sophie Powell is the manager of the fittingly named fashion store Irregular Choice.
Box Park literally popped up in a week, and so people have been a bit confused whether it's been here all the time and they've never noticed it. So they're very excited. It's also nice for office workers to pop down on their lunch break.
The appeal of pop-up retail is that it's here today and gone tomorrow. The mall will be here for 5 years, and there are others planned for London and Amsterdam. Staying in London, and London Fashion Week kicked off today with a catwalk show from British designers Antoni and Alison. The models on stage at Somerset House in the capital showcased a range filled with bright colours and bold patterns and prints. And finally, President Sarkozy of France may not have brought much cheer to the French recently, but he has them laughing now over his official re-election campaign poster. It shows Mr. Sarkozy in front of blue waters under the slogan La France Forte, or Strong France, but it emerged that the photograph on which his face is pasted was taken in Greece and is entitled Clouds Over the Aegean Sea. Dozens of spoof versions have since been put on the internet, with one saying La Grèce Forte, or Strong Greece. Those are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. That was, I'm ever so sorry I had to interrupt you in your bulletin there whilst that soundbite from the shopping mall was playing.
Yes, popped up literally.
Literally, yes. Very curious. That's in shipping containers.
No. It's near the east end of London where all the ships are.
Right.
So it's kind of like they're making use of that vacant space.
Very good.
And the other strange thing is it's only going to be there for 5 years. It's going to move on to somewhere else.
So it pops buzz. Up. You've got to get there while it's there.
Exactly.
Absolutely. What have you been pouring through as the Australian papers come
in? This is interesting. This story keeps going on and going on. All this intrigue over Julia Gillard and Kevin Rudd. They never really liked each other. He was the former Prime Minister. She is now the current Prime Minister of Australia. Don't forget, she's holding on to a 2-seat majority in her coalition government because one of those Liberal MPs became Speaker. She was originally on a 1-seat majority. And now some cabinet ministers have begun rallying for her, in support of her, criticising Kevin Rudd and betraying anxiety that he's gaining support. A small group of ministers this week privately canvassed Labour MPs in an effort to shore up support for Julia Gillard. At least two of them badmouthed the potential challenger. Kevin Rudd is also the Foreign Affairs Minister. In the process, it's the clearest evidence yet that her position is under real threat and her most senior supporters and her most loyal supporters are worried. And don't forget, this government is only on a 2-seat majority, so it could fall
very
within.
Very slim, yes.
Yeah.
And it raises questions about, when you're questioning whether or not Rudd was pushed out or that Gillard stick the knife in, as some have suggested, it says a lot when somebody can make a comeback to the top seat of power like Rudd.
Exactly, because as you pointed out just a few days ago, I think in the very same paper they were saying that Julia Gillard knew full well that she was plotting to take over from Kevin Rudd weeks before she said she was going to take over, and it looked like she was the innocent party or the catalyst. But in actual fact, I think it was in the Sydney Morning Herald a few days ago we were discussing this. It announced just then that she had planned this weeks before to get rid of Kevin Rudd. So all this intrigue and skullduggery,
always,
politics, what a game.
In politics, yeah. I know, who'd be in it? Yes. Looking also at the Sydney Morning Herald as well today on their front page, the former boxing champion, Fortunato, or nicknamed Lucky Gattalari, he is being dubbed the country's biggest supergrass. He's exposing the mafia's activities in Australia and huge dealings with local councils and government officials. It's popped open quite a big can of worms, it seems. And it's an unlikely person to do that, a boxing champion who I'm sure many would say, well, I'm sure he's seen a few things in his time because boxing does attract certain spectators who are from certain circles.
Yes, wasn't it a judge in Sicily that changed the mafia, that managed to change the mafia now in Sicily no longer exists pretty much. They're very much dispersed and they've now moved to Naples. But it's through the action of a judge who stood up to the mafia and he eventually got assassinated. I can't remember his name. But this reminds me, now we've got a boxing champion doing the same thing
in
Australia.
Well, he can handle himself.
Well, it's amazing, isn't it?
Even against the mafia. He's not scared of the mafia.
No, good for him.
Good
for
him. Thank you, as always, Jonathan. We'll get the global weather now with Thomas Schaffernecker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
Let's have a look at how the weekend is shaping up in Europe, and quite a mix of weather on the way. Some rain heading to the UK, France and Germany, snow in Eastern Europe. There will, however, be at least one sunny day this weekend in most major European cities. It's also going to turn a little colder in Western Europe come Sunday, only temporarily though. The weekend city outlook, can in London, rain on Saturday, but a sunny Sunday on the way, 6 degrees. In Berlin, 5 degrees and rain. In Zurich, snow possible on Sunday, 0 here, and in Rome 13 degrees with sunshine and showers. Over to North America now, a sunny start to the weekend on the east coast of the US. However, Sunday may bring some unpleasant weather. In the deep south, so Texas, Louisiana, a storm is expected to brew and it'll bring rain to most of the southeastern states through Sunday, and most likely a rain and snow mix for the capital, DC. So the weekend city outlook in Washington, DC, 3 degrees with Sunday rain and snow. Boston, 6 degrees, partly cloudy. In San Francisco, around 13. and sunny, but in Vancouver, 6 degrees with some rain showers. Here's a look at some other world locations. In Hong Kong, partly cloudy, around 18 degrees. And both in Shanghai and Tokyo, if you're here, sunny and chilly for the next few days, 5 degrees by day, but zero or even below at night. Sydney, the weekend is looking humid with sunshine and a good chance of catching some heavy thunder showers. Highs here around about 28 degrees. And that's the weekend weather. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Thomas. It's 10 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette
Monocle 24.
Es ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 Tagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei ole koko.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Broca Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, Ecuador's highest court has upheld a ruling against a national newspaper for libeling the country's president. Daily paper El Universo accused President Rafael Correa of misusing Ecuador's army when he was trapped in a hospital during a violent police protest in 2010. Correa was awarded $40 million, and the paper's columnist and owners were sentenced to 3 years in prison. The penalty is likely to see the paper close after 90 years of business. The case has raised further questions about the freedom of the press in Latin America, not least by the Brazilian media, which is now seen as the leader against perceived corruption in the region. We're now joined on the line by Milton Coleman, the president of the Inter-American Press Association and the senior editor of the Washington Post. Milton, firstly, let's go over this incident, this protest, where it all started.
Well, it all began with an incident during a police protest of the Ecuadorian police, and President Correa came down there, and one thing led to another, and at one point, he tore open his shirt, and he felt he was being held hostage in a hospital, and apparently he then asked the military to make sure everything went all right. And within that situation, there was a suggestion that he ordered them to open fire. And there were a couple of people killed, I believe. After that, the Ecuadorian newspaper El Universo, in a column, not in a news story, in a column by the editorial page editor, questioned the president's behavior and raised a concern whether in the future, if someone acted as President Correa had acted, that person could be considered a dictator and could be held accountable for crimes against humanity by suggesting that the military open fire on its own people. President Correa then, casting aside that he was the president, brought criminal charges as an individual against the columnist, as well as the owners of the newspaper, which in and of itself, both there are two or three different violations of Inter-American Commission on Human Rights values there, and the court with all sorts of irregularities, including the sense that the final opinion was written by Correa's lawyer, sentenced him to 3 years in prison and $10 million each. And because of the way it occurred, the money would go directly to President Correa. And all of those things are really an affront to democracy, because democracy requires that you have politicians who are accountable once they go into government, and that they should have a higher threshold to claim that they were libeled.
I'm so assuming really there's... Sorry to cut in,
democratic
Milton.
Processes in Ecuador, as well as a serious endangerment of the freedom of expression, because the lesson it says is that if you dare to criticize the president of the country, even if it's only a criticism in thought, if you dare think something that the president does needs to be called into question, you will be driven into exile, your business will be closed, and you will go to jail.
And I'm assuming there's been no precedent for a civil case against a title of this scale, but is there a precedent of with this paper in particular, or other papers for that matter, of publishing and questioning the morals of the president?
Well, first of all, no one's questioning the morals of the president. What was questioned in the article was the actions of the president. What Correa sued on were questioning of the morals of Rafael Correa, not President Correa, but Rafael Correa. So is he the president or is he not the president? I don't know about British law, but in U.S. libel law, there are two different standards for what can be considered libel. In the case of an ordinary citizen, sloppy reporting can be considered libel. But in the case of public officials, it has to be shown that the news organization printed something that was wrong, and at the time that they printed it, they knew it was wrong, and they printed it anyway. But that concerns facts. There's no such thing about libeling thoughts, or being libeled by thoughts, and that was the case here, that because this editorial page writer, called into question and asked people to question the actions of the president, he therefore had dishonored the individual who happens to be the president.
Now this has reached the highest court of the land. Is there any further that this can go before the owners are sent to prison and this fine is imposed? Is there an international court that this can be raised with?
There is an Inter-American Commission on Human Rights and an Inter-American Court of Human Rights, both based in Costa Rica, in San Jose, Costa Rica. And the case probably will go there. It will take some time for it to be adjudicated, but there is a belief that what President Correa did was to knowingly violate these... let me back up a second. It is, in my opinion, quite unlikely that the Inter-American Court or the Inter-American Commission would uphold this because it violates so many of the principles. But I don't think that was the lesson that was intended here. It was meant to be to have a chilling effect on the press in Ecuador, to let everyone know that if you dare to criticize this president, we will take away your business and we will throw you in jail unless you leave the country and close down.
How is this case being covered by the rest of the media in Ecuador?
I don't know because I'm not in Ecuador, but I've not been to Ecuador in several years, but I suspect that they're covering it as best as they can, but I also suspect that it has had a chilling effect on some people.
Milton, do you see any wrapping up of this case in within months, or will this be drawn out for years, long after he leaves power?
Well, it all depends. There's an election next year, or this year rather. I think it's in October, and we will see what happens there. But the government has already passed laws that severely restrict the ability of the media to cover that election. They cannot interview some candidates. They cannot write about the results of polls. So you see, it becomes what we have here is people using democratic principles to destroy democracy.
Milton, thank you for that.
They vote into existence things that continue to restrict freedom of expression. Whether it will go on, how long it will go on, I don't know. The president has said that he may pardon the people involved. All four of them are all out of the country now. And I don't know how long El Universo can continue. But I think the effect is what the president wanted. That is to make sure that people are taught the lesson that if you dare think that in this democracy you can raise questions about the conduct of your president, you are mistaken. You will pay a heavy price. You will be driven out of business and maybe out of this country.
Milton, thank you very much for that. Milton Coleman, the president of Inter-American Press Association, speaking to us there. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, where it's coming up to 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be back in a moment.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes and quips of the week, tune into The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design hour. It's a show about the things that we live with. Join us as we take you on a tour of the finest furniture, buildings and fashion from around the world. From ramshackle warehouses to luxury runways, hard hat construction sites to the safety of the studio, we bring you the people and products that fill our lives.
These people find a common ground, and you know if they do that you're probably onto something that everybody in the world might be able to agree with.
Tune in each week to hear about the things that make life better. That's Section D, premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, here on Monocle 24.
I think it's time for some music now. This is Pumped Up Kicks by Foster the People. Welcome back to Midori House. Now, every day on the show, we are joined by one of Monocle's editors. And today, as it's Friday, we have Monocle's Santiago Taditi with us to talk through what's happening in the world of food and lifestyle. Welcome, Santiago.
Hey, Chris, how are you?
I'm good. You do have a very nice job, don't you? This is the second week in a row you've brought in a bottle of wine.
I can't complain. Second week in a row, bring a bottle to this show.
To this
because,
show?
Yeah, you will normally see me carrying a bottle around the office.
He's never without a wine. So what is this one that you've got in front of us?
I have a wine made with Nero d'Avola and the Frappato grapes from the south of Sicily. This is a wine company called Inicon. And
it's quite apt that you've brought wine in because that's what you've been covering this week, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of news from the drinks industry. I'm going to start with one from Moët Hennessy. They're moving to China and they have invested in a vineyard in the mountains of China to produce red wine for the local market.
For the Chinese market.
Yes, exactly. And
are they traditionally wine drinkers, or is this a new phenomenon?
No, I think this is a new trend that's growing in China because the middle and upper classes are also growing.
Yes.
So there is an interest in taking up on these customs from all over the world.
Absolutely.
Obviously, wine is one of these important trends in life, you know.
It's how you end your day, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But something funny is that they're still developing that taste, and they usually, I've heard stories of them mixing red wine with Coca-Cola or making punch with red wine, just going for the most expensive bottle and then pouring it together
nice.
With soda and fruits and just drinking it that way. But anyway, there is a growing trend, and Moët Hennessy, the LVMH group, is very interested. They just bought 30 hectares of vineyards in the mountains of Yunnan in southwestern China.
Right.
And this is not the first time that they've made a big move in China, because 5 years ago they also acquired a Chinese spirits brand in the Sichuan area.
So they're developing quite a thirst for alcohol now in China. As you say, the growing middle classes, as they're getting used to the working days and the stresses that the developed world has had for many, many decades. They're now needing a drink at the end of the day.
And I think a glass of red wine is always better than a cup of tea.
Yes. I hope you're going to open that bottle there.
I will open it after I continue with my news, if you don't mind. I'm going to leave the best for the end.
Yes.
Because another story I wanted to share with you is that 1,000 of bottles of rare cognac and other vintage drinks went up for sale. These are owned by a Dutchman.
This is a cellar.
A cellar, yeah. He owns this cellar. Mm. He inherited from his family, who have been collecting bottles of wine and cognac and other drinks and spirits for many, many years. And it's described to be as the largest collection of old liquors in the world. A total of approximately 5,000 bottles of whiskey, Armagnac, cognac, and they have an estimated price of $8 million.
And 5,000 bottles.
But you know what's curious? The guy who owns it, a person called Van der Bunt, doesn't drink wine or alcohol.
Oh, wasted on him. Although that's why he's selling it, I suppose.
And I'm guessing that, well, it is a good way to invest, no? Mm. If you don't drink all these bottles. I would personally open the bottles and drink them eventually.
Exactly. But it goes to show there's some cash in many people's attics and cellars. Not quite as much as this fellow's, but...
Yeah, you're always hearing stories about someone uncovering like a very antique bottle from the basement of the grandfather's house or like a shipwreck or something like that.
It's keeping it though in the right conditions, isn't it? Because you can keep a bottle of wine for years, but if it's too cold or it's too warm, there's no point keeping it. It's a waste of space.
Well, now that you say that, I would like to know what the bottle of Brugerol cognac this person has in his cellar tastes like, because this is a hand-blown 6-liter bottle that was produced in 1795.
Wow.
And apparently it was once owned by the French Revolutionary Army officers and toured around with Napoleon's convoy.
Amazing, what a history. And they obviously like their volume, and it's 6 liters. Quite a bottle.
Yeah, that can keep a whole trooper
going
on for many days. This bottle alone is 138,000 euros. So if you only want to buy one bottle, can be the case.
We'll start a kitty. We'll start saving now. Look very nice and very ornate, a bottle of that size.
But you know what? Let's go back to my bottle. It's not as expensive.
No, it's more modest.
As the Brugerol cognac, but I'd like you to taste it because I discovered this 2 weeks ago. As I was saying, let me open this.
It's one of Santiago's top tips for this week.
Yeah,
it's a personal favorite.
So don't be scared of the screw cap. I know some people are scared of the screw cap. They think... it's only for cheap wine, but it's not true.
It's just a coincidence that this is a cheap wine.
Well, it's not cheap wine. It's a cheap that has good value and good taste. Now that you're looking at it, you can see it's bright.
It is very
bright
limited.
Red.
Yeah.
Very very shiny. The Nero d'Avola is one of Italy's most interesting grapes found in the south in Sicily. It is very bold grape, and the Frappato on the other side has a nice fruitiness to it. So you will taste soft tannins. That means that every time you sip, your mouth won't be dry or you won't feel that.
That's absolutely right. It's very light.
That astringency you sometimes feel with like stronger wines like Malbec or Rioja wines like that. It's not too overpowering, and it leaves like a lingering and velvety feeling, something like a nice fruity aftertaste.
Yes, it is. It's light. You could even have this in the summer. It's not too heavy.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is beautiful. I'm holding a glass in my hand. Santiago, you're always welcome in this show on Friday, as long as you ring a bottle.
I will.
Have a lovely weekend. Thank you, Santiago Tedici. As always, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's the bottom of the hour here. We'll be back in a moment with the news headlines.
LDNTYO NYC MTV.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, coming up in the next half hour, we'll be speaking to the author of a new book about Afghanistan and its conflicts. But before all that, we'll get the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Thanks very much. Rupert Murdoch has vowed to launch a Sunday edition of his scandal hit Sun tabloid today in a bid to win over angry staff, mounting one of the biggest challenges to his more than 40 years as a proprietor in Britain. The 80-year-old said that News Corp would soon launch the paper to replace the News of the World, which was abruptly shut last year after an inquiry into telephone hacking to generate stories. The Israeli diplomat's wife, who was injured in a New Delhi bomb attack on Monday, has been released from hospital and may soon be on her way home, according to her doctor. Talia Corrin was on her way to pick up her children from school when the bomb attached to her embassy car exploded. She suffered shrapnel wounds in the blast, which also injured her driver and two people in another car. Scores of Jordanian and Syrian activists rallied near the Russian and Syrian embassies in Amman today to protest against Russia's support of the Syrian government and show solidarity with protesters in Syria. Protesters from the Strong Islamist Movement joined the angry crowd as they chanted anti-Russian slogans and called on the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to step down. The world's first pop-up mall, Box Park, has opened up in London's fashionable East End, where retail meets shipping container, literally. The appeal of pop-up retail is that it's here today and gone tomorrow. The mall will be here for 5 years, and there are others planned for London and Amsterdam. Staying in London, and London Fashion Week kicked off today with a catwalk show from British designers Antoni and Alison. Models on stage at Somerset House in the capital showcased a range filled with bright colours and bold patterns and prints. And finally, President Sarkozy of France may not have brought much cheer to the French recently, but he has them laughing now over his official re-election campaign poster. It shows Mr. Sarkozy in front of blue waters under the slogan La France Forte, or Strong France, but it emerged that the photograph on which his face is pasted was actually taken in Greece and is entitled Clouds Over the Aegean Sea. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. It's time for a song now. This is Nantes by Beirut.
Well, it's been a long time, since I've seen you.
That was Nantes by Beirut. Now, joining me in the studio is the only journalist to have witnessed every Afghan military campaign of the past 5 years. Ben Anderson has survived IED explosions and sniper fire and has witnessed firsthand the actions of the Afghan police and army. As if that wasn't enough, he's now written a book, No Worse Enemy, the inside story of the chaotic struggle for Afghanistan. It describes the relentless task the troops in Afghanistan face. Welcome, Ben. You were just handling your hardback book there. You say it's the first version of the hardback that you've seen, and you were reading the comments on the back, which are all amazing.
I sent the book to a few of my heroes, a few of them that I'd never met before, and you know, thought if I'm lucky I might get a reply from one of them. And they've all come back and said very kind things, so I'm delighted.
The back is full from top to bottom. Exceptional. Essential reading. What is it about Afghanistan that the public doesn't already know in this book?
I mean, especially over the last year or so, and that's why I decided to write the book, that because the policy now is just get out of there without being too embarrassed. Mm. The statements we're hearing are the exact opposite of what I was seeing on the ground. You know, we're meeting our goals. The Afghans are almost ready to govern. They're almost ready to provide security of themselves. The Taliban have removed from their homeland in the south of the country. All absolute nonsense compared to what I've been seeing for the last 5 years. So I thought I've got to get everything I've seen down in paper in one place and show people how bad it is, so that hopefully it's a bit harder for us to once again abandon Afghanistan, which looks like what is what's going to happen.
Was there ever a time when the public perception was in tune with the reality on the ground there?
I mean, I think there was a very brief period when we first went in that there was optimism on all sides, and Afghans believed what we were going to do. We believed that, you know, it was going to be easy because there was so much goodwill for what we wanted to do. But straight away, the focus was on Iraq.
Exactly. So, what did you see happen from there on in?
We put in the very people who had almost destroyed Afghanistan in the first place, the most corrupt, evil warlords there had been, the people who were so bad to the country that the Taliban were able to sweep to power so easily, because people thought, well, at least these guys are good Muslims. At least they won't rob us and rape our children. So the Taliban swept to power because these guys were so evil. We put those very same people in power just because we wanted someone who was tough enough to provide a semblance of security. And from there, it descended over the next 5 or 6 years. And we didn't really take the war seriously until 2006, when we moved for the first time into the south of the country. And that's when the insurgency really started.
But the interest from the public here and the rest of the West diminished as Iraq picked up.
Yeah, and then
the target changed, didn't it?
I was trying to get in there in 2006 when the fighting was really picking up again, and there was no public interest whatsoever. And the Ministry of Defence were banning reporters from covering the fighting. But the soldiers started releasing their own footage on YouTube, on their mobile phones, on helmet cameras. So the MOD eventually relented and let some of us out there, and we showed, you know, some really ferocious fighting, some of the most ferocious fighting the Brits have seen since you know, the Korean War. So then public interest picked up and it was all about our boys and our heroes. Mm. And I think now the public have actually got sick of that because it's just lots of kids coming home without legs and no one really knows why. So I get the impression now, I had a film that was shown in America last year and we expected it to have quite an impact. And actually the public reaction there was the same as it is here. And it's, you know what, unless it's news about us coming home, I just would rather not know.
Too much negativity now.
Nothing but bad news. Really, yeah. Nothing but bad news.
You say it's the worst conflict that British troops have been sent to in 50 years.
Yeah, and I was with the last two or three times I was there with the US Marines. Some of them were proud of their nickname, which is the Butchers of Fallujah. They said the fighting in Afghanistan is much harder and much more intense than anything they've seen in Fallujah. It's just so much more of a complicated situation in Afghanistan. And we're trying to introduce a very unwelcome, a hated and feared government and police and army to a people who just don't want it. And to a people in the South, particularly, who prefer the Taliban. They'll say, look, they've got very harsh laws. They've got very harsh justice, but it is justice. They do provide security. Mm. They don't tax us at checkpoints. They don't abduct our children. So, you know, even if the military operation goes perfectly, we're then trying to introduce the Afghan government, who are totally unwelcome. So it just can't win.
So your view would be organic growth within the country and allow them to form their own stability?
It has to be Afghan-led. Mm. And we've got to stop saying the Taliban are awful and our guys are great. Mm. Because the reality is, most of the stories you hear about Afghanistan in history, you know, about, you know, Sharia law and brutal treatment of women and children, that's not, the Taliban didn't introduce that to the country. That's an Afghan cultural problem which needs to be improved slowly over time. You know, we've tried to make it far too black and white. And because now there's no time to try anything else, it's just about having enough numbers on the ground to make it look like the Afghans can do the job themselves, and then we can leave without it looking too much like a defeat.
What is the level of support for the Taliban in Afghanistan?
I mean, in the South, very high. I mean, there have been lots of conflicts in Afghanistan over the last 30 years, but they've all been fought on very similar lines. It's the northern ethnic groups versus the Pashtuns who live in the South. And it's still roughly the same. And when we say we're introducing the government or the national army to the South, it's not a national army at all. It's the Northern Alliance. It's the ethnic groups from the North who don't even speak the same language as the people in the South. So, you know, the Taliban in the South enjoy complete support amongst the Pashtuns. They are Pashtuns. Not all Pashtuns are Taliban, but all Taliban are Pashtuns. So it's not really a case of the public in the South supporting the Taliban. Often they are the Taliban or they're related to the Taliban. And given a choice between the Taliban and the government, they'll choose the Taliban every single time. I think Pashtuns who live in the south of Afghanistan or in the same area across the border in Pakistan will say to you, I'm Pashtun first, I'm Muslim second, and maybe I'll describe myself as Afghan third. So this idea that we can unite them all under one government and one army and one police force
is unworkable. It's naive.
Totally unworkable. Totally naive.
You mentioned it turned into a damage limitation exercise for the West towards the end of the conflict. Withdrawal was just on everybody's mind. And do you think lessons have been learned when we look at the Arab Spring countries with the uprisings we saw last year and now the conflicts that are still ongoing in the region? Have the West taken the foot off the throttle for a second and not intervened to the level at which they did with Afghanistan?
I don't think they will intervene to that level for a long time. I think a lot of them will see Libya as a kind of model intervention from now on. But, you know, Libya was led by Libyans. Mm. And I think if there will be any intervention in the future, it's going to be that kind of intervention. I mean, I think one of the great, you know, the real shame of Afghanistan and Iraq is that we really could have got it right. And there are other interventions, Congo, Liberia, Uganda, where a very small force could do an awful lot of good and save thousands of civilians. I think there's almost zero chance of that happening now because Afghanistan and Iraq were such disasters.
The situation in Libya, which you mentioned, was it a clearer, more simple issue? Were the lines and the boundaries, the divisions clearer than they were in Afghanistan?
Afghanistan is very complicated. You know, the tribal allegiances, the ethnic differences. I mean, you know, there's not
so fragmented
and different languages even. Mm. I mean, I've seen a governor that we installed in a village in the south turn up and speak to them in a language they don't understand, and these kind of problems. And you know, the translators. It's things as simple as the translators. I would often film meetings with Afghans, and then it wasn't until I got home and hired my own translator that I realised what was actually being said, and it was a million miles away from what the soldiers on the ground were told were being said. So something as basic as that is just pure chaos out there.
When you look back, you spent many years there. What sticks in your mind? Are there any memories that you'd rather forget but can't?
There's been a few real close shaves. And at the time, you just get on with your job. But yeah, you think about them afterwards. And you think, I mean, I've had a couple of friends have been badly hurt. One, a New York Times photographer, probably he wrote The Bang Bang Club, Joao Silva, probably the bravest, most experienced, you know, correspondent out there. We were together in Kandahar for a few days, went on two different patrols, and he stepped on an IED. I mean, we were actually very bored and tried to get somewhere else, but couldn't get there, so went out on patrol anyway. And he lost both of his legs at the knee. And when you think about that, and you get that feeling that you're coming back with a really important story that everyone should know about, and it's on television or on the radio, or it's in a book, whatever, and actually the reaction is kind of, you know, I'd rather not know. And then that plus the thought that you could have been seriously wounded does make you think maybe I should start thinking of something else to do.
Yeah, are you glad you know and have seen what you've seen?
Yeah, I'm very glad. I mean, you know, it's I was the only member of my family to go to university. I quit after the first year because I just felt like it was a huge waste of time. Now I feel like I'm getting the best education I could possibly get. You know, I read all the books and all the papers, but then I get to go out there and see it for myself with my own eyes. And I just feel so privileged to be in that position.
And anyone thinking of heading to a war zone as a journalist, what would your advice be to them?
It's actually a lot easier than you think. There are a lot of war reporters who you would think were brave, hardened combat veterans who actually don't get... You can go to any war-torn country and stay in the same hotel as all the other journalists. You can eat very good meals every night. You can drink wine every night. You can socialise with your friends. You can have affairs with other correspondents. That's what a lot of foreign correspondents do. They spend as little time at the sharp end of things as possible. Photographers are different. Photographers spend weeks and weeks on the ground because they have to. Correspondents, you know, I've been very disappointed with what I've seen correspondents doing or not doing on the ground. So if you do want to do it, it's not that hard for you to get out there and really get a unique story that no one else is getting.
You've just shattered an illusion there for me,
Ben. I've had many illusions shattered over the last few years.
Ben Anderson, thank you ever so much. That's the author Ben Anderson joining us here at Midori House. We'll be back in a moment.
Monocle Films, the cinematic eye on the world that brings you crafted stories from affairs to business, culture to design. Plus, our weekly Monocle briefings featuring original concepts in travel and retail. Premiering this week, high-performance innovation from the biggest sporting goods trade fair in the world.
There's a real nice vibe for almost what we're calling gentleman explorer. Those people who used to go to the Arctic in just a jumper and an extra pair of socks and that beautiful styling coming through. So, yes, some really nice heritage product.
You can find this and over 400 more films on monocle.com.
It's 47 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's time to head over to Norway to check in with our culture editor, Robert Bound, in Oslo. Rob, how are you, sir?
I'm very warm. I'm actually surprisingly warm, Christian.
Are
I'm
you?
Thinking of you in Studio One there.
Oh.
And I'm not feeling too bad. I've stepped outside of a party to celebrate another Norwegian festival called Oya, which is going to take place in the summer, where they've turned the heaters on. Or maybe there's just so many people in a basement that it warms you. Warms the cockles of your heart.
Or it's the beer that's warmed you up, Rob.
I do have one in my hand, yes.
Well, what...
Just to chill it down.
Tell me about this LARM festival that you've been to, or something of a music conference, they're calling it.
Yeah, so BLARM is sort of halfway between a music conference, music convention, which is the business side of it, which is where A&R people meet bands and where label managers meet kind of distributors, and especially in the Nordic area, it's more and more things like Spotify, which is Swedish, and a new thing called the Vimp, which is Norwegian. And then the other side of it is a good old music festival, which is for fans to go and queue up in the snowy streets of Oslo and around the corners of the venues to go and see their favourite act. So it's a kind of balancing act between the two.
What struck you about the atmosphere there? Like you say, the temperatures aren't exactly hospitable at times, and you're queuing outside venues to see acts. Must be a real passion, or is it that the talent's worth it over there?
I think the talent's worth it, and I mean it's mostly homegrown talent. I mean the people of Oslo and the surrounding countries, I suppose, are coming to see the bands are seeing bands that probably are breaking or are big. I suppose it's the first opportunity in the year that people get to see their big Norwegian superstars, people like Anna Brun and people like that that we've been lucky enough to have playing for us at Monaco. I guess it's the first time of the year they get to see them. But, you know, then again, it's not outside in a field. Obviously, it's using the bigger indoor venues that are around the city and some of the smaller kind of dive bars and kind of jazz clubs and things as well. So it's kind of quite nicely distributed. But, yeah. There is also a stoic attitude to queuing in the cold.
Do you get an insight as to some of the acts that will make it out of Norway and to the wider market across Europe while you're there?
Well, you do. You never quite know. I was speaking to a guy today called Knut Gjertason, who's in a band called Turbo Negro, which are a big band, and he's just in a band called Mirror Lakes, and he was saying you never know from one year to the next people are hyped at Bilam, and then maybe it's the people that were kind of, you know, third on the bill that actually kind of make it and are headlining the next year. So I guess it's, you know, it's always a bit of happenstance and a bit of luck, but it's, you know, you feel privileged to be seeing some of the smaller acts and some of the bigger acts up close. But I suppose, you know, being a rock clairvoyant is a tricky job, but I've certainly seen some good stuff and got a lot of demo CDs and interviewed some bands as well, and it's all quite accessible. It's very sort of Scandinavian or very Nordic in the way that you're not confronted with a wall of PR machinery. You know what I mean? You can go and meet and greet people, anyone you want.
It's not on some upper echelon at which you have to idolise the act and only dream of one day meeting them. It's a very different experience, isn't it, when you can shake hands with the musician?
Yeah, exactly. It's nice. Everyone's good, and it's one of those things where everyone's like, you know, the PR exists to give you the mobile number of the band. You can go meet them rather than being a sort of smokescreen of cool. Do you know what I mean? It's a nice difference.
You can be the smokescreen of cool, Rob. Is it been just music this trip? Have you just been having your music hat on, or are there other areas of culture that you're bringing back with you from this?
Well, I think the duty-free shop's still very expensive for me to bring back any sort of other kind of transparent culture, like the decent Norwegian gin. But it's mostly music. And this festival, unlike some of its sort of peers, like South by Southwest, which happens next month in Texas, which has grown a big film arm and a big media arm, this is quite purist music, although, as I say, there's a lot of talk about distribution and there's seminars and conferences about how to get people's music out there and how to get it listened to, considering, as we all think, at least if we don't know, that you know, you can't make money from selling records anymore. You have to, you know, you have to get people to pay, you know, £20 to go and see a live gig at least, and then get them to buy the t-shirt. So there's all those discussions going on at the same time as all the bands are playing all night.
£20 a ticket, unless you're Robert Bound. I'm sure you get showered with freebies wherever you go.
Well, I was going to say, but I don't know. I mean, things are expensive in Oslo, but I don't know. I mean, you know, in London, I think to go and see anyone of the sort of size that plays at the O2, you're kind of probably looking at least £80 or more for a ticket that gets you to the very back of the room. So, I suppose it's always worth bands to get bums on seats.
Robert, I'll let you get back to your party and you can get another beer in. Thank you so much for that, Robert. Stay warm.
Nice to speak to you. Thanks a lot.
Take care. That was Robert Bound, Monocle's culture editor, speaking to us from Oslo. You're listening to Midori House. Now we head to our favourite butcher in another part of our Meet the Neighbours series. This time we talk to Erica Kaluakati, the manager of the Ginger Pig in London's Marylebone.
Hi, my name is Erica. I'm working in the Ginger Pig, Moxon Street, Marylebone, as a manager at the moment, and a butcher as well. And working here already about a couple years in this shop, and I started in Waterloo as a deli side person, and now became a manager. Our Ginger Pig shop, we've got 5 of them at the moment, and our Ginger Pig Marylebone shop is very nice and one of the oldest shops we've got in London. It's already about 10 years as it opened, and it's a very nice shop, big shop. We do daily things like pies, Scotch eggs, traditional sausage rolls and things like that. And we also have got meat counter where we do our free-range meat, which is pork, lamb, beef. We do some poultry as well, and we do some French veal, which is very good as well at the moment. Well, the best-selling things in the shop is actually beef. Our beef is kind of special because we aging our animals and everything. So we aging our beef and starting it from 28 days, and we can finish them up to 60 days if customer prefer like that. Yeah, so that's most popular actually, all steaks and all traditional cuts of beef. What's special? Well, this shop is special. It's like everything I've got is Marylebone shop. It's very nice shop to work. I've got very good butchers here. I've got very nice time here. I like working in the shop, doing all things. I love customers and everything. I mean, this beautiful shop is kind of old style, and we do, because we do all English cuts, all traditional things. And coming in the carcasses, we're preparing ourselves, so it's kind of special.
You say, sir? How can I help you?
Pork chop.
Pork chop? How many would you like to have?
Many people still value the butchers like us, because we do everything in front of them. We show everything how we do. We're always happy to help our customers, and yeah, they like our meat very much. I don't think meat in packs is good at all. We know where our animals came from. We can tell for customers that information, which is very good, and they love that.
That was Erica Calloquet, the manager of the Ginger Pig in London's Marylebone. It's time for a song now. This is Kelly by When Saints Go Machine. That was Kelly, When Saints Go Machine. We're out of time for this Friday edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump, researched by Fernando Augusto Bacheo, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Next on Monocle 24 is The Menu with Marcus Hippie.